Welcome to Accounting High.
So nobody knew it was you. You were just out there as Ira Gilligan.
I'm going to say like 2019, there was a tax Twitter back then. And that's why I came out of the closet as myself and started like using my real name and actual photographs and tweeting actually as myself and not Ira Gilligan. Because people were talking about work stuff and work-life balance and asking tax questions and what's so-and-so's expertise and who can I ask this question.
But you're still Ira Gilligan. If you were a rapper, Ira Gilligan could be your rap name. Ooh. Because it's your other persona. It's your other alter ego,
it's
right?
It's my alter ego for sure.
Your alter ego. It's like your Slim Shady.
Yes.
For me, it's my little toddler or OKR.
Yes.
May I have your attention, please?
Live flow.
Ooh.
We're going to continue this train of live flow. And we're going to have Terrell come on.
If you have the skill of an accountant and you think like an entrepreneur, you can help every one of your clients make an extra, a minimum, several thousand dollars a month, depending on the size of the business, based on the limitations of the process. If you want faster responses from me, we need to make an investment in a tool. I'm going to help you make more money so you will be able to afford this and other stuff you want to do.
You recognized there were limitations in the process. And
workflow restraint sheets out of date, creating daily time constraints in case you misplace data, chasing clients as they run away. It's safe to say it only takes a few minutes to copy paste. When you finish, you waste the days as you delicately navigate. You comb through and hope sales don't break and make sure no mistakes were made. Ain't up to date, you change the date, but now you're in the wrong decade. So LiveFlow came to save the day, upgrade old ways and change the game. The time you save created space to double your entire client base. No trouble raising your compliance rates, eliminate migraine headaches. They integrate with live updates, so no more copy, no more paste. The data you consolidate stays up to date when not awake. Explain a way to take the same template you made the other day. Just duplicate, don't recreate. They pave the way to plug and play. They elevate amazing ways as they upgrade and iterate. A no-brainer favorite, greatest new cloud-based tool to automate. To give a grade, I give an A, and jobs would say it seems.
Live flow is just a play on that word, processes. Workflows, processes, live flow, right? So live flow is being inserted in that process to then create an entirely new process that's better too. And that's their product. I think that's beautiful. That's awesome how you did that.
May I have your attention, please?
Welcome to Accounting High. It's freshman year at a brand new school. Here, we have no rules in place as we're on a mission to set our own traditions. So hang tight and learn with us as we grow. At Accounting High, you can expect to gain knowledge in a completely different way than what you may be used to, with some fun and oftentimes colorful conversations. Whether you loved high school or you hated it, here's your chance to be a part of an unforgettable experience redone. While you're here, don't forget to follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you may be listening to us right now so you don't miss out on any new episodes. And feel free to leave us a 5-star review letting us know how the school year is treating you. In addition, share this episode on social media, tagging us at Accounting High. So sit back, relax, and open your mind because class is in session.
I repeat, may I have your attention, please?
This is another public service announcement brought to you in part
by Accounting High.
The views and events expressed here are
of the next generation of accounting and tech professionals leading this space.
The events and suggestions are not to be taken lightly. Children should not partake in the listening
of this podcast.
Anything else?
Yeah.
So without further ado, introducing the star of our show,
Scotty and Sabrina.
We're going to have a problem here.
Class is in session. I have with me the Sabrina Cook, a.k.a. Ira Gilligan. We're going to get into what that is. And she's joining me from North Carolina today, too. We got two North Carolinians. This is rare on this show.
The Tar Heel State. Here we are.
Tar Heel State. Well, you're App State. So technically you're a Mountaineer. Mountaineers. Yeah, we'll get into that. But before we get to the college part, this is Accounting High. We're high school. Tell me about your high school days. Did you want to be an accountant back then?
No. No. High school was fun for me. I loved high school. So I was like a huge nerd. I mean, I guess we were all pretty nerdy. We're accountants, but I was a huge nerd in middle school, and my high school was like huge. And so I kind of had the opportunity to reinvent myself. And so
was this in North Carolina, right?
It was, yeah. And, you know, I had the opportunity to kind of write my own story in high school. And, you know, because I was in all the like advanced math classes, like all my classmates were upperclassmen. And mm-hmm. so I could kind of like make new friends and kind of get in with a different crowd and maybe not seem as nerdy, but like seem like I was like smart, but like in a cool way. I don't know. That was kind of my thing.
Oh, no, but, no. I definitely know that feeling. I was always in AP classes. We didn't have upperclassmen at my high school because I'm in the Triangle in North Carolina. And we had new high schools cropping up every few years. New middle school, new high school. So every school I went to was brand new. I didn't have upperclassmen. So that's naturally, wild. You're always cool if you are always the upperclassman, right? Like, that's a whole different experience. So you're with the cool kids, though. That's another series we have on here. So this might be in the social studies series, but this is we also have the cool kids. So you would be part of both, right? Social studies, the cool kids.
That's
so you were
to.
In the cool kids crowds. You were partying with the upperclassmen as a you know what years were this? You were in the AP Math, AP Stat, AP.
Mm-hmm. I did all the AP classes. Yep, Calc 1 and 2 my senior year. Yeah, this was like 1997 through 2001.
Okay.
So, played soccer in high school, was not good at it at all. And I played midfield, and they were like, you're getting really winded on the field. Like, we think maybe you should maybe start running cross country to kind of get in shape for soccer season. And it turned out that I liked running way better than soccer. And so that kind of kicked off my love of distance running.
Oh, dope.
Okay. Yeah.
And so then you pack up your bags and go to Appalachian State, which isn't even that far for you, right?
Right. So I went to Wingate for undergrad. Do you know where Wingate is?
I don't know Wingate now.
It's just outside of Charlotte. No, different Wingate. It's a small school just outside of Charlotte. And I had a full scholarship there. Went there all for 4 years of undergrad, and then I got an internship at Deloitte, and Deloitte made my job offer contingent on me getting my master's, and I already had the 150 hours, but they still wanted me to get my master's. So I went to Appalachian. Mm-hmm.
So beyond the whole, you know, this whole 150 hour debate and mm-hmm. everything, this is dictated by the larger firms anyway, and they're going to make you get your master's. They're going to make you do all this other stuff. It's not even just about the hours.
I agree. Yeah.
And you did it anyway, though.
Yeah. You know?
So you ended up at Deloitte. At what point did you decide, I'm going to do this whole CPA thing, accountant thing?
So my senior year of high school, I planned on majoring in psychology, and I was like super interested in it. And everybody was like, well, you know, to make a lot of money in psychology, you're probably going to have to go on like beyond your undergrad degree, get further education. And then even then, there's still no guarantee. And I'd grown up in poverty and really kind of wanted a guaranteed paycheck when I got out of school. Mm-hmm. And someone had mentioned accounting to me, and I started looking into it and saw that 97% of accounting grads had a job waiting for them out of school. And I was like, well, I like those odds. So my senior year in high school,
you were good at math.
Yeah, and I was good at math.
All the math stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and so my senior year, I took both psychology and accounting because, you know, this huge high school, I could take whatever I wanted, but I took both psychology and accounting. And I've told this story on Twitter before, but I'll try to keep it PG. But the psychology class took us on a field trip to a mental health institution and a prison. And the prison portion of the field trip kind of sealed the deal for me that psychology was not the career for me.
And give me some highlights of this. You don't have to keep it too PG. I mean, we're all adults here. What happened there that really impacted you?
Grown incarcerated men dropping their pants in front of us, like 17-year-old girls.
Okay.
Are you following
now? Fair enough.
Yeah.
That's the traumatic experience. And how did you frame that with that psychology? Like, and that's why you ran away from it? Or was it just that in particular experience and you associated with psychology?
I think I realized that the mental health portion of it was like mental health things that I had never even conceptualized before.
Or and have so, never experienced.
So, yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I wanted to help people. And here we are, like, as accountants, we help people, right? It's mm-hmm. a completely different way of helping people.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's honestly a better way. I think a lot of times, at least with me, whenever I wanted to do psychology is because I wanted to better understand myself and mm-hmm. my motives and what I was doing. And once I started to better understand that, then I could apply that to other things and apply it to other business and people. And it was always entrepreneurs with me, or it was always some kind of business or creating a business and doing that. And that's what I learned. Like, you can do that with anything. But
yeah, it's very relatable.
So, but early on, you're working with businesses through a company like Deloitte. And in that case, you're not really having an impact when you're at that level. You're just doing what you're told, and you're not even working with the clients, are you?
No, not much. No. So I started my career in the multi-state practice. And full disclosure, I loved what I did. So this is like Nexus Studies, voluntary disclosure agreements, a little bit of state credit work, but like no compliance. Mm-hmm. Just a lot of research. Cool.
So it's like research. Yeah.
A lot of research. And I love the work. But I got married and moved to Hickory. And at the time I was like, well, nobody needs a multi-state consultant in Hickory. So
not in Hickory, not then.
Yeah, like, not then.
The internet wasn't as huge. I mean, it was up and coming. This was in the early 2010s,
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I figured, you know, my options were industry, government, education, or public. And to continue in public, which I enjoyed public accounting, I was going to need to learn QuickBooks and small businesses and 1040s. And I was still so early in my career that I felt like that was the route to go. And so I did. And I really liked it. I mean, to your point about not really working with the clients, I really liked having that face-to-face contact with small business owners and like feeling more like I was making an impact on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. If you feel like you're helping people and you can see that change that you're making, or you can see what you're doing, that's a huge motivator to keep doing what you're doing, and a driver like that impact can really get you pulled into the work. And how were you doing this first? Were you working at a smaller firm or?
Yes. So when I moved to Hickory, I went to a small firm, learned, you know, tax compliance, learned QuickBooks, learned bookkeeping. And so this was wild to me, right? Because even when I had done compliance at Deloitte, I would get a trial balance. The trial balance is already tied out by the auditors, you know, everything, the trial balance balances. And then going to an environment where, you know, the bank reconciliation doesn't reconcile and stuff is classified wrong. And like, it was just a whole new world to me, you know, but it was what my boss said. And she had Big Four background too. She was like, mm-hmm. Sabrina, this is like a puzzle, and you've got to put the pieces of the puzzle together before you can even get started on the tax return. And I was like, okay, I can get down with that.
I love the puzzle analogy. We use that a lot in different aspects, but especially in accounting, because there's always, it all fits eventually. You know,
right.
It could be a mess on the table. Literally, it could be a bunch of papers and other that you get to where, you know, filter through. But in the end, it's a picture.
Right.
It looks like something, and the numbers paint the picture. So what types of businesses were you working with at this firm, or what were you doing?
A lot of blue collar stuff, which a lot of it's clients I'm working with now. So blue collar, like plumbing, HVAC, repairs, a little bit of manufacturing, a whole lot of furniture. So I live in the furniture capital mm-hmm. of the US, so lots of furniture.
Oh, dope. Okay. And in the meanwhile, you're just settling into, you're starting a family? Do you have any kids at this point, or what was the situation there?
Right. So I think my daughter was born after I'd been married for like 3 or 4 years. And I took the opportunity to stay at home with her for a little over a year. And I hated being a stay-at-home mom. It was not for me. I couldn't wait to go back to work.
You're a hunter. You wanted to get done. You wanted to work. So that wasn't cut out for you to stay at home. And then you went back to work. What'd you end up doing?
So I went to another firm, and you know, there was no bad blood with the old firm, but obviously when I quit, they had to replace me. So I started looking for something else, and I found a firm in Hickory that was a lot of Big Four alums, some people I had gone to graduate school with, even a couple of people I had worked with at Deloitte. And they had a lot of pretty high profile clients, like some of the largest businesses in, you know, Western North Carolina. And it was a really good fit. So I was able to use a lot of the Big Four skills, but I still got that FaceTime interaction with clients. Really felt like I was making a difference, and it was a really good balance. It was a really good team. They were super progressive. It was just a really great place to work, honestly.
So through all this time, were you still running or doing any kind of long distance or any other kind of hobbies outside of that too?
A lot of running. And that was another cool thing about this firm. This firm was like very much supportive of all of my addictions, including running. So they would like sponsor me to do, they were like, you know, we need someone to run this half marathon so we can like put an article in our newsletter. And I'm like, sign me up, let's do this. So yeah, they were like super supportive of all that. And yeah, it was, that's when I started getting really into like pushing myself into half marathon and full marathon and stuff like that.
Talking about addictions today with my team, and there could be some positive addictions too. I get addicted to everything I do. And
yeah, same here.
You know, running or any kind of fitness stuff, that's an addiction as well. I mean, you get that dopamine hit from that. It's a much healthier addiction than others, but it's all the same. Yeah.
That reminds me, I want to ask you a super personal question. You don't have to answer it, but do you have ADHD?
Oh, God, yeah.
Okay, me too.
Vyvanse. We both take Vyvanse.
Yes.
I've been on 70 milligram Vyvanse for like, I don't know, 20 years, 15, 18 years, something like that. Well, we could talk about prescriptions too. that's all topics. Anything is on the table here. But yeah, that's, I have ADHD. That's a like always been a thing with me. This is not even about me. We're not talking about my ADHD. Your ADHD, when did you figure out you had it? Because I didn't really, it's always been a thing, but I never really figured it out till later in life.
Same here. I did not get diagnosed until right about that time, like my mid-30s. And my doctor at the time was kind of like, you know, some of the things you're telling me about, like loving your job, but having trouble staying focused and being disorganized and losing things, like, let's test you for this. And I mean, I had all the signs, and it hit me like a ton of bricks, because I mean, you know how it is. We were both super high achievers, and then
high functioning,
it's crazy. It's like, really, me, ADHD? But then like once I learned more about it, it totally made sense.
And that gets back into the mental health stuff too, because and it's a spectrum too. I think I'm on, you know, I've been starting to learn like where I sit on that spectrum, and how like I can really tunnel in and focus on one thing and close everything off and just do one thing, but I can't do anything else like in that time. And if I get a little bit distracted or get pulled out of that, then it's very frustrating. I can't do anything else. And typically, if I'm not on my medication, you could tell. Like, it, I'm sure other people could tell too. If you're not on yours, like, we're entirely different people.
Same. Yes.
It's my PED. It's my performance enhancement drug. That's what I say. Like, without that, I could function, but not high performance. Like, not like I don't know. That's just, it was always growing up, like, there was always kids that were labeled as ADHD and had Ritalin. That was right around the time we were growing up, that Ritalin came out, Adderall. And my brother was diagnosed when I was a kid. And I knew kids in school and I was getting, I'm not like that. You know, I was always like, I'm not like my brother. I can do all this stuff. I don't need medication. But it was the other side of the spectrum. It was all the other things and how it was affecting my life on a larger scale. It wasn't like maybe as noticeable, but it was, you know, definitely taking away from a lot of things. So
yeah. And I think one of the hardest things for me was that understanding that medication is just one tool in your toolbox. You have to still put in some work in terms of creating good habits and sticking to a schedule and not procrastinating and not letting stuff pile up and not putting yourself mm-hmm. in situations where your ADD is just completely unmanageable.
Well, we can get into the habits too. I did a great job when talking about habits and doing my habits last year. This year I've fallen off, so I try not to talk about them as much, but we can talk about your habits and how you keep up with things. But yeah, now, you know, you're still working at another firm. It's within the story, right?
Right.
You're just figuring out that you have ADHD at this time too?
Right.
While you're working somewhere right. else? Yeah. Did you tell anybody or were you keeping it to yourself?
No, I kept it to myself. My philosophy has always been that, you know, HR's function is to protect the company and not you. And so I never really saw a benefit to me personally to disclosing my ADHD, certainly not to HR. And I didn't really feel a need to disclose it to my team. I think they knew though, and they were super accommodating of me and would kind of go out of their way to fill in the gaps where I was short, coming up short.
And I definitely want to see where Twitter fits into here when you started on that, because that's probably been a pretty big, you know, part of your life too. I mean, just for our audience, you have over 10,000 followers on Twitter. That's a pretty big deal. Not too many people in that club in our tax Twitter field. So you've been setting yourself apart from the rest in that realm, but it doesn't sound like you were heavy into it then, or were you at that point?
I was, but it looked very different back then. So this is so wild, Scott. Let's get into the Ira Gilligan. So for those of you who don't know, Ira Gilligan was the accountant on Arrested Development. And so in Arrested Development, the storyline is basically that this family, the patriarch of the family, gets sent to prison for fraud. And the son is kind of left to pick up the pieces. And there's all these crazy characters, like the attorney and the CPA. But anyway, the CPA's name is Ira Gilligan. And originally, when I got on Twitter, I was kind of like a troll account. Like, my whole personality was Ira Gilligan. Like, I wasn't really tweeting as myself.
So nobody knew it was you. You were just out there as Ira Gilligan. So okay. I have in my orange shelf, I have the Arrested Development DVDs
so behind good. Me.
DVDs too, right? Like, I don't even know what to do with them. So I put them on my color book shelf now, because you could pretty much just stream it. I don't even know where you could stream Netflix, I'm sure.
I think so, yeah.
It was my favorite show on TV because it was unlike anything else on TV. And the way that they told the story and the way they, like, it was just so, it was meta for then, and nobody really had anything that was that meta. Like, they were referencing the show and also referencing the narrators, referencing himself. I just loved all the quirky stuff about it. And I didn't remember the accountant or the accountant's name until you just said it. Like, and now your name makes sense too. I didn't know what Ira Gilligan was. I didn't even Google it. I just thought it was your own, like, persona. I figured it was some kind of persona. And it's an accountant, too. That's dope. That's what the Bluth's banana stand is on your... So you started the whole, like, Arrested Development craze within tax Twitter, too. Because I see other people with their Bluth shirts now, too. And was there tax Twitter when you started hopping on there? Like, it looked a lot different, but...
It did look a lot different. And I don't think we were, like, calling it tax Twitter. So I went down a rabbit hole a few months ago and was trying to find the origin of tax Twitter, and people weren't really using the hashtag until, I'm going to say, like, 2019, but there was a tax Twitter back then. And that's why I kind of, I guess, sort of came out of the closet as myself and started, like, using my real name and actual photographs and, like, tweeting, like, actually as myself and not Ira Gilligan. Because people were talking about work stuff and work-life balance and asking tax questions and, you know, what's so-and-so's expertise and who can I ask this question? But it was a lot smaller.
But you're still Ira Gilligan. If you were a rapper, Ira Gilligan could be your rap name. Ooh. Because it's your other persona. It's your other alter ego,
it's
right?
It's my alter ego, for sure.
Your alter ego. It's like your Slim Shady.
Yes. Yes.
For me, it's my little toddler, or OKR.
Yes.
So that's so cool. So you have an outlet to be yourself. Did anybody close to you know you were doing that before you went out and told everybody? Anybody close to you know, like, this was your online persona? Were you growing a following then?
A few people knew. So my sister has always followed me on Twitter, and she knew that it was, she knew that I was who I was. And then a fellow Deloitte alum knew who I was. And then like a handful of Hickory people knew. But otherwise, no. And part of that was intentional. I didn't want necessarily like work people or clients to find me.
You could talk about work stuff on there freely and nobody's, it's never going to come back to you.
Like, right.
I remember when I first started going on Twitter, you were one of the first accounts I noticed. Part of it was the North Carolina thing, because I'm there as well. But also, you're so funny on there. Like the stuff that you say is unfiltered. It's so raw, but it's so real too. And I love that. I don't like when people put on, like when you say you have a persona, you know, some people may think it's a different persona, but really it's truly more you than probably the persona you're putting on when you're going to the office or your day-to-day life. That's more you, and that's more real than anything else.
Right. And when I went out on my own, I decided to be very intentional about being very raw on Twitter and being very unfiltered on Twitter, because I felt like so many people in our profession are very buttoned up all the time. And even at Deloitte, I'd been told that I was like too unfiltered and too, you know, a little bit redneck to an extent. And I feel like if we're all just super buttoned up all the time, I think a lot of really important conversations aren't happening. And so when I no longer had the
you can't relax if you're buttoned up.
Exactly.
If you're buttoned up, you literally can't relax because you can't breathe with all the buttons.
And I wanted to be someone that people could say, oh, somebody else is experiencing that. Oh, there's another CPA with ADHD and Vyvanse. And oh, there's another CPA who experienced that other thing. Maybe I can reach out to her and talk to her. And I found that that was a thing that was happening. People were coming in my DMs with things that they didn't want to say publicly on Twitter, but they felt comfortable telling me. And I was glad that I could be an ear for them.
You're an inspiration for them too. Inspiration for me, then I could start talking about my stuff. Somebody else is on there talking about everything, and why not? So that's kind of how I got started. That's a little bit of that. And so, you know, going from starting your own practice, I do want to talk about that. So you're working at another firm as all of this is happening. How did you end up deciding I want to start my own thing?
Sure. So like I said, things were going pretty good at that firm that I was at. I loved the work I was doing, loved my coworkers. So my marriage was not going well, and I was married to another CPA, and we never could really get the division of labor in our home down pat. And it just got worse after our daughter was born, because it just kind of seemed like everything was falling onto me, which made sense when I was home for a year. Once I went back to work, it was like I was still responsible for cooking, cleaning, maintaining the household, all the doctor's appointments. And it was like, I can't be everything to everyone and work in this super high demanding career. So, you know, my marriage was kind of coming to a close. And about that time, the firm I was working at was having to have kind of some come to Jesus talks about turnover in their audit department. And so to manage the turnover in their audit department, tax people were being asked to work an audit, which normally, you know, I'm a team player. I'll do what I got to do. But traveling all over the state 7 months out of the year while I'm trying to meet with my attorney about my divorce and meet with my realtor about finding a new home, the timing was terrible. And so I tried to have some proactive conversations with leadership about what my future there looked like and how long I was going to need to be a team player. And I really didn't get good answers. And I know that, you know, they had already given me so much. They had already done so much for me and bent over backwards. So I get it. If they couldn't bend over anymore for me, I understand. But at that point, it was time for me to kind of spread my wings and fly and make my own destiny, that kind of make my own version of work-life balance if I was going to be a single mom.
you're already going to have a lot of life changes. You might as well go all in with everything, right? Like, you're really figuring out who you are at that point.
Yeah, it was of all the times to decide, hey, let's start a CPA firm. Like, let's just change everything. Let's move. Let's get a divorce. And let's start a CPA firm. Just go all in.
Why not? It's that must have been so hard, though. Like, I guess it goes back to you taking that 1 year off and realizing that's not me. I can't just stay at home. I'm not a stay at home mom. And I think people expect that of, you know, I guess I could just talk about society and our today's days when you have two people working, everybody always assumes that the woman is going to stay at home. And that's not always the case.
Right.
You have hunters and you have gatherers. You identified yourself as, I'm somebody that wants to be out there hunting.
Oh yeah.
I need to leave the house. I need to have that separation and go work and then come home. And when you realize that you cannot have two people that do that, or else nobody's raising the kids. Exactly. Or somebody else is for you.
Right.
And that's never good developmentally for kids. They need to have their parents and they need to have somebody there for them.
Yeah.
Too. So that's hard. So you realize that. And then all of a sudden, like, now your whole life is upended. And at no point in there, it's like, did you even ask for all of this, right? Like, this was just, felt like it was happening to you. But then at one point, did you take over and realize, now I got to take the reins in all of this? Yeah.
I did, yes. And the cool thing is, I had so much support. And all I had to do was ask. And really, some people I didn't even have to ask. A lot of people just wanted to jump in and help, which was awesome. But a lot of people in the business community, just Hickory has a really good business community anyway. Entrepreneurship is very much encouraged. And when they saw kind of a younger CPA, so just for point of reference, there are a lot of, you know, 80-year-old white dude CPAs in Hickory who need to retire. Mm-hmm. And God bless them, because, I mean, a lot of those dudes have given me a whole lot of knowledge, but I think a lot of those dudes would do good to kind of enjoy their last years and do something other than sit behind the desk too. So
that's all they know. That's all they've ever done.
Right. 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 And it's hard. I get it. I get that it's hard to let it go. And we're truly blessed to work in a career that, you know, you, as long as your mind's sharp, I mean, you can do it way late in life, but I think at some point it's time to let some younger generations take the reins. And so when people saw me as, like, you know, I'm in my mid-30s at the time, wanting to take initiative and start a CPA firm, I mean, people were like, how can I help? What can I do for you? And it was really cool.
Yeah. So you had a lot of support from the local community. I'm sure you also did on Twitter. If at that point you were vocal about what you were doing.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. So what year was this that all this was happening?
This was like 2017, 2018.
17, 18. Okay. So the cloud's pretty much in full effect at that point. Mm-hmm. We're pre-COVID, obviously. And what kind of, you know, so you get support from the community. What did you bring clients from the other firm? Did you just start getting your own clients?
So on my way out the door at my old firm, they were like, by the way, you signed this non-compete on your first day of work. And I had no recollection of this non-compete whatsoever. And I looked at it and this non-compete was rough. I mean, it was like, I couldn't work with any of my old clients for like 3 years. Oof. Yeah. And I had an attorney look at it. I mean, I was like, and I think I got on Twitter. I was like, who is the best non-compete attorney you guys know? And they directed me to some really good guy in Raleigh. And I got about an hour of his time. And he was like, look, here's what this means legally. You also need to think about what this is going to mean for you professionally if you try to fight this. And so basically what it came down to was that the non-compete probably wasn't going to be super enforceable after about a year. But at the same time, in a small town like Hickory, do I want to rock the boat? Do they want to rock the boat? Who's going to look like the bad guy? And I was thinking about, you know, what a good relationship I had with them and how if I continued to position myself as someone to be in a good relationship with, mm-hmm. you know, we can continue having a good relationship that's beneficial for both parties. and that I would really be jeopardizing that if I was going to cause legal trouble and fight this non-compete. And so I started completely from scratch. I did not try to go after any of my clients. And the couple of clients that heard I was starting my own firm, I was very clear with them that they were in good hands and I wanted them to stay where they were.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So again, that must have been hard too. That's taking the bigger, that's the play in the really long game for you, because in the short term, you need money. Like you need money coming in the door in any way you can get it.
Scott, I was working in my new office from, 8 to 5 every day. And then at 5 o'clock, I would grab a microwave burrito and then drive Uber until 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, you were also doing Uber.
That's how I was That's how I was buying groceries, Scott. It was insane.
Did you get any clients while you were Ubering?
I did. Oh my God. One of my favorite clients that I met during Uber, he got in my car, just kind of a late 20s, got in my car and he was like, we're just making small chat. I mean, that's one of the cool things about Uber is you get to talk to all kinds of people. And I was like, yeah, I actually just started an accounting firm and I just do this nights and weekends. And he was like, so I moved here from Germany and I'm going to need a good CPA. And I'm like, I'm your girl. And I gave him my card and he called me. And I mean, we've been working together 5 years and he's so funny because when he comes to my office, he's like, I'm so proud of you, Sabrina. You've got an office and you have a team and you're the American dream. You're why people want to leave Europe and come to the US because you were an Uber driver and now you have a CPA firm and employees and you're stimulating the economy. And I'm like, I've never thought of it that way, but I guess you're right.
It's true. Everything he said was true. I mean, in a way, Uber was your office then.
Yeah.
He met you at your office. That was your mobile office. Now you got a legit office. I mean, I guess you had one there. You were going, was it the same office you were going to then, or have you moved
since? I've moved, yeah.
Okay. So that's awesome. And that's, you got to hustle.
For sure.
If you're going to get anything done, and once you know that hustle, then it's in your blood. I think that's also part of the addiction talk too. We could get addicted to this work thing too.
For sure.
I know I have.
Yeah.
Get addicted to the hustle. And so what were some of the instrumental things early on that changed the direction of the firm? Like things that you learned or things that, that were impacted you as an owner?
Well, like you said, early on, you just need money coming in the door. And so I probably wasn't as picky about making sure clients were a good fit, which is hard because then eventually you have to part ways to make room for clients that are a good fit. And people had told me that advice, but I was like, yeah, but if I take this client, I cannot drive Uber this weekend kind of thing,
right.
And so it's hard. It's hard to make those good decisions, but I ended up taking on quite a few clients that were not a good fit in the long run and ended up having to part ways with them last year because they were causing me a whole lot of stress and not adding a whole lot to the bottom line.
Well, starting from scratch, money could afford you the luxury of saying no to certain clients and knowing what the right client is and knowing when to say no. But if you don't have that, you're going to have to take on anything you can and then deal with the consequences later because you got to be able to make money first. I think a lot of us did that because that's how we started. We needed to make money. So we were just taking things that came in the door and then developed our systems and everything. Afterwards, it was always backwards.
Right.
So, unless you have that runway, financial runway, to be able to do things intentionally, it's hard to be intentional. I mean, you were already at that stage too. You were already dealing with so much in your life that you didn't have the time to really think about, should I take this client on or not? Are they going to be a good client? You didn't even know what made a good client.
Right, exactly.
From that perspective, you kind of were working with people and you were taking on probably similar types of businesses, right? The ones that you were working with at the other firm?
Correct, too? Yes.
All locally. Were you doing stuff online or did you have anything remote at that point?
Yes. When I went out on my own, I did start taking on some remote clients pretty early on. And those are always awesome clients because they adapt your technology. They want to use the portal correctly and they want to follow procedure. And those are always really fun clients to work with. So yeah, I would say pretty consistently from day one, like 15 to 25% of my clients have been fully remote and not necessarily in the Hickory area.
Oh, dope. Yeah. And I know you have remote employees too.
Right.
But, you know, this is all new for a lot of people still. Like, I think COVID was a big jump starter, but doing things remote and having remote employees and all of that, it just opens up. It opens you up to be able to do different things and
yes,
a whole lot more possibilities.
Correct.
So right now, do you have an ideal client type? I mean, after learning those lessons, did you ever really figure out what types of clients you wanted to take on?
I know when we niche, we're supposed to really think about industry specific, and that's been kind of hard for me. I don't know that I'm ready to like call a particular industry mine, but the work that I have found is enjoyable and highly lucrative is fractional CFO, fractional controller, and advisory work. So mm-hmm. we have built some monthly packages that lend itself to being very beneficial to small business owners that don't necessarily have the budget for an internal accounting department or even a controller, really. But we can fill that role on a part-time basis, a lone staff basis, and really kind of be there for them to answer those questions and get that work done. And it's great for us because then we have the monthly cash flow and the books are in order for us to do the compliance too. So it's really kind of a win-win for us and the small business owner. And that's kind of the niche that I've put myself into. But in terms of an industry, they're kind of across the board. It's a lot of service. It's a lot of, again, the blue collar, you know, someone who started off as a landscaper and now has like a whole fleet of landscaping, or a plumber and now they have like a team of five or six, or manufacturing. Manufacturing is really good too.
So do you have like a revenue target? Typically, like, we don't take clients under a certain amount of revenue or a certain size.
Kind of our sweet spot is, and this is a pretty wide range, but like 5 million to 20 million in revenue is kind of a sweet spot for us. Mm-hmm. And then, like, you know, employees, having payroll is, and even though we don't do payroll, but like having payroll is a good sign that they're in our wheelhouse.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. And it's, I agree with you there. That's pretty much what we started doing. We never industry niched at our firm.
Okay,
either.
Cool.
That's the one thing I talk about it all the time. I tell people that's what you should do. And I was just talking about it today on our team meeting. Like, we still haven't done it and we still haven't picked. And I think that's where we got hung up, is trying to pick, because we have, in a sense, it's not an industry vertical. It's not an industry niche. It's just a general client persona across the board. If it's this, then we'll take it. Otherwise, and we've created a pretty good system on our intake form that weeds out the people that wouldn't be a good fit. So it's still like knowing who to say no to. And, you know, I guess you get more comfortable too once you start having more recurring revenue and you have more clients, you can do that. You guys still do taxes though. You don't do payroll, but you do taxes.
Correct.
So was it, now you're sort of doing work during the year to lead up to the tax return, so the tax return's easier. Were you always doing the books or write up or, I dare I say, CAS, whatever else that is, before the advisory CFO stuff? Were you doing that along with the taxes?
No, initially I would try to get that work, but a lot of times these business owners were so small and they kind of bought into that, oh, if I buy QuickBooks, that's all I need. I don't need you. And, you know, I wasn't being forceful enough about, yeah, I know you really do need me. Like, you're not a bookkeeper, you're a plumber, you need me. And so now we're a lot more forceful about it. Like, if you're going to try to DIY your books, like, you're not for us. So.
Yeah. Your spouse isn't going to be able to do the books. Like, it was always the case. Oh yeah, we got our QuickBooks and I'm going to have my wife do it. You know, she's never really done bookkeeping before, but how hard could it be?
That's exactly what it is. Yes.
Or, you know, it's all always that same story, or my brother-in-law is going to do it, or my mom is handling my books.
Right.
So we don't need to pay you.
And then my team is doing an entire year's worth of cleanup like a week before the tax deadline. And it's just, no, we're not. We're not going to do that anymore.
So, yeah, I mean, and so through all this time, you're building a business and you've also got your daughter, and you know, obviously, like trying to figure out who you are in this mess of everything too. Do you feel at what point did you feel like you were on the other side of all those changes and all that, those big life changes? Did you feel like you were comfortable with where things were at?
Ooh, I get comfortable and then I get uncomfortable again. But I know that, I mean, pretty early on in my firm existence, I would say a year or two into my firm existence, I felt like, man, I've got it made. I've got a book of business. I make my own schedule. You know, I'm bringing in steady income. I go to all my daughters. I never miss anything. Yeah. I've got this down. And then scaling was really, really hard. And so when I tried to scale, it was like, okay, this is not as easy as I thought it would be.
What do you mean when you say scaling? What does that mean?
Well, once I started hiring more people and trying to delegate work. And so another thing that was super hard is my firm was still kind of in growth mode during the pandemic. And so, you know, we had that year where the deadline was pushed to July 15th. And I was able to like take on more clients and take on more clients and take on more clients. So then the year that the deadline went back to April 15th, we had some major, and everybody had compression issues, but boy, oh boy, did we have compression issues. And these were clients that had never had to go on extension before. And it was very hard reprogramming and teaching them that extension's not a bad word. Extension's a very good thing. And it's not a bad thing if you have to go on extension and lather, rinse, repeat. So all of that combined with I'd gone from working by myself to managing a team of four and delegating the work and making sure everybody was following procedures. And it was kind of a disaster.
You have to figure out what those procedures are. Because when you're doing all of it, you don't really have procedures. It's just all happening.
Right. Right.
You're in the middle of all of it. So that's really hard. That's a very difficult position or a growth phase. I think that that's probably one of the hardest is to get yourself out of the way and to delegate the stuff that you're doing and figure out what you're supposed to be doing and how to get out of the way, because you know you're going to take a hit in your margins because you need to hire people to do the things you were doing, and would you know you're interfacing with all the clients at that stage too. So how do you phase yourself out of those clients? They're going to want to see you. They're not going to want this new employee that you hired, regardless of how good they are. They want to work with you, and that feels good, right? They want to work with me. I want to help them. Did you ever have at what point were you able to, did you ever get out of interfacing with all the clients? At one stage, do you have somebody that handles that now?
Yeah. So my team, I have just the best team. I mean, I've been really blessed in terms of hiring just awesome people. And I attribute part of that to being, I'm looking for certain personality traits as opposed to the skill set, because I feel like the skills can be taught. Personality traits cannot be taught.
I love that.
So the people that work with me are just awesome and are go-getters. And if I teach them the skills, they want to make my life easier, which is awesome. So they've done a really good job of just kind of inserting themselves over and over and over again. Like, hey, I'm your point of contact now. So, and the other thing is, you know, when I'm getting 100 emails a day, a lot of those fall through the cracks and don't ever get answered. But they found out that, hey, Amy and Lily and Zach reply to my emails. I'm just going to start forwarding all my correspondence to them. And so they have kind of started to learn that they get a much faster response when they go through my staff and senior and intern. So that's been really good too.
Yeah. Oh, that's huge. What are some of the soft skills or the traits that you look for in people, you know, just in general, or do you have anything specifically that you ask or do?
I'm generally looking for a positive attitude, a can-do attitude. I'm looking for people who aren't like married to a job description. Like I'm looking for people who aren't going to say, well, that's not my job, that's so-and-so's job. I'm looking for people who are going to pitch in where things need to get done. Because with a firm as small as mine, there's going to be times where everybody kind of has to do everything until we get a little bit bigger and can separate the duties a little bit better. And so having an attitude that like something isn't your job is not going to serve you well here. I'm looking for intellectual curiosity. And I don't know. That's a good question. Good vibes.
I don't know if I know the answer. Good vibes. Good vibes only. I love that. That's a tough question. And I don't know if I know the answer to that. I know that it's a lot different now. We really have a structure and a system and an accountability chart and things that we didn't have back then at that stage. At that stage, it was anybody we hire is going to do everything that I was doing for this client. They're just going to do it now. And there wasn't like a separation of, okay, we have this level of review and this level of client. You know, right now we have like a management team at the firm that's handling the things I was doing. And that was a huge cut on my margins too. I got somebody internally operations facing and somebody externally client facing, you know, client success and ops. And those two people don't do any client work either. So how am I going to hire somebody that's not doing client work and still like be able to pay everybody else?
That's such a leap.
It's huge. And it takes time. Like, it's phasing people out of stuff, phasing people into things and figuring out what you want to do too outside of that. Cause once you get out of all the seats and all the roles and the things that you're doing, then you still have to have a purpose. You still have to have something to do too. So the question that I'm really going to ask is why scale too? Because in some cases, firms that are just one person shows, they're making a good enough living. They're happy. Everything that they're doing is great. But then they see everybody else growing and doing this and hiring employees. And they're like, I want to do that too. And then it gets a lot harder. So I'm wondering, I always ask people why scale or why try to put yourself through that if things were good.
Right.
Maybe they weren't
and,
great.
And that's the million-dollar question. And I think a lot of it at the time was, you know, that's just what you do. You know, if you're good at what you do and the next logical step is get bigger and do more of what you're good at. And I didn't take the time to think, what if I just kept it small and what would that look like?
And if you kept it small, it might not be something that you're building toward like an asset that you can sell, because it's much harder to sell a client list than it is to sell a business,
right?
You know, or you're just not going to get as much. Like when you're a solo person show, you're just selling a client list basically versus a business that's running. And I think there's that middle area of very difficult growth phases for a firm to get to. And I'm still learning what those phases are and how to help people get out of that. Cause I think that's what Accounting High is going to be, is to help people get through those phases and decide, do they want to scale?
Right.
And the difference between a solo show and a scale is, I think a scale is something that's working without you. You can step away from for 6 months, 8 months and do something else, and it's still happening. And I didn't realize I got there at my firm until I started doing the show and started doing other things. And I realized like we just had our best month ever and I didn't do anything last month. I was like, I still haven't really done anything because I keep doing the show and my raps and stuff. So I'm going to try to start teaching people how I got to where I was, because honestly, it was all by accident, maybe accidentally on purpose, but it all happened a lot slower. And I think we could speed up that process and get some systems in. And there are people that do this, that have done this. There are lots of education out there. So who are some of your favorites? Like some of the Ryan Zanis, we got Jason Statz. Who are some of the ones that you pay attention to these days?
Right. So, and that's kind of the beauty of Twitter too, is you can kind of see what other people are doing. But I love to hear what Jason has to say. Jason Statz, I love to hear his insight. And then someone who I feel like doesn't get a lot of love is Will Hamilton. Are you familiar with him?
Oh, I don't know. I know Hamilton. But that's Lin-Manuel Miranda. That's not Will. Yeah.
So Will has a program called Smart Path, and it's kind of similar to Thomson Reuters' like canned platform for like moving your firm towards more of a CAFS approach. But like Will is super low key about it, because I think Will is the face of the business and Will's the one doing the coaching. But he has he's got this whole portal with templates and ideas and training and all this really cool stuff. And I feel like nobody ever talks about him. And so I always like sing his name from the rooftops because he's such a cool guy and so creative. And he's made the advisory piece like so easy. Cause I remember when I first started talking to him, I was like, do I have the skill set to do this? And he's like, do you have an accounting degree? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, yeah, you can do this. And it's just plug and play, man. As long as you're willing to do the work to like work with the right kind of clients and like get your client mix to be folks that are like on a monthly subscription package, which is, you know, what I've been working towards, like you can do it.
Yeah. I mean, anybody can do it. It is hard work. And if somebody's giving you practical steps, ways to apply that knowledge, I think that's the hard thing too, is everybody's talking about doing stuff and how you do it. But then what's the practical step? What's the first thing I need to do to get there? And if they're telling you that, then anybody can do
that. For sure.
And again, it's always hard work. Change is hard. You've been through so much change and you learn that we fear the change because we also fear that, you know, I think we just fear the unknown too. And we want to avoid that pain. So we want to keep things the way they are. And if you're forced into that change, then you realize the change part is actually not as bad as we fear. And it's always getting on the other side of that you really realize that. And, you know, you're living proof of that. And I think, you know, right now it's like still, I think you're still in that stage of getting to the point where you've scaled. And that's a journey. Like that probably takes at least 4 years. And I don't know if I can figure out a way to speed that up, but that's why Accounting High is, it's 4 years. It's a high school,
right?
So we're going to take people on that 4-year journey to get them so they could scale. And I think you're right there in that no man's land of solo and scale. And you're in the middle there. And that's the hardest place to be as a firm owner, because you're still going to be the bottleneck and you're going to be the stopping point for anything to happen. You can't really take that much time off because everything backs up. Even though you got employees handling emails, you still have to make the decisions on a lot of things and sign off on certain things. You're probably still reviewing stuff. Things don't really happen without us when we're in that no man's
land. For sure. Yeah. So, I'm always the bottleneck.
Yeah. So let's start talking about that more. I want to see what are some of the areas that you got next. So, you know, without going into too many details, you've got a team. Each person's role, are they all the same right now?
No, I have a staff accountant and I have a senior accountant. My senior works remote from Arkansas.
What's the difference? When people say staff and senior, I don't even know what the difference is.
That's a good point. And at my firm, our senior accountant, both are prepping, right? Both are preparing tax returns. Sure. Neither is reviewing tax returns. But my senior has way more experience and he's able to prepare kind of more advanced returns. So
you give them the more complex stuff,
yes.
Right? You give them the higher value stuff to work on and the things they could leverage better. But there really isn't a difference between, if you look at it side by side, are they pretty much doing a lot of the same things, just different client bases, client types?
Yeah, kind of.
So the biggest thing I did to change that, because that's what we were doing too, was, and it took a while, but we decided one person's going to do all the prep, all the work, all of the legwork to get things there. And the other one's going to do the review of that and then get it ready and interface with the client. So you had one person that was client facing and they could handle more because they weren't doing any of the grunt work. They weren't putting the puzzle together. They weren't putting the edges around the puzzle. They maybe weren't even putting the puzzle together. They're just looking at the puzzle to make sure the pieces are in the right spot. Sometimes somebody puts a puzzle together and they try to fit pieces that don't fit, right? And then the person below them, that's the one that's actually collecting all the source docs, reviewing, coding, or doing anything that needs to be done. They're doing most of the work, and that's all grunt. But if they're not interfacing with clients, then they also have less stress and they have less context shifting because they can just get in there and get it done. And a lot of accountants love that, especially people learning how to do stuff. That was one thing that we did early on or years ago that set the stage to being able to then eventually get people to phase out of certain roles and to create a difference between our roles, because everybody that was doing work was all just doing the same thing. We just had four people doing all the same things.
Yeah. So. And that, you know, and that's a big part of the reason you get bottlenecks is because if your reviewer is also prepping and managing and all the other things, I mean, yeah, of course you're going to get bottlenecks. So.
And your reviewer wants to take some time off. Then
right.
What?
Right. Right.
Yeah. There's no redundancies, or if there is redundancies, it's just somebody taking on all somebody else's work temporarily.
Right. So at what point did you get to where you were kind of able to take a step back out of the client technical work?
Well, technical work, I took a step. I phased myself out a lot faster, but the review and everything, I was slowly phasing out, but then it was COVID that I was actually able to. So I got stuck in Mexico. So I had an external event that really like hit the eject button on everything that I was trying to do or fast forwarded it. And it was just like, okay, now I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm staying in Mexico. You guys are here. You're going to figure out the whole work from home thing. They figured everything out without me. And then I realized how much I wasn't needed when I was away. And so that was a big ego hit. It's like, wow, they really don't need me. Like what am I good for? Right.
Yeah.
It's also when I started doing the show, started doing the podcast. So I occupied myself and occupied my time with other things too, because if I didn't have something to occupy my time, then I would have still been fiddling around, poking around in things when I got back, and I would have, it would have got right back to where it was. So I found something else to then realize they can make mistakes. It's not that big of a deal. Maybe they're not going to do as good of a job as I was on some things, but you know what? I found out they were doing a better job than me in most things too. And the things I thought they may not be doing as good of a job, like the review and all the things that I felt like I needed to do, it was just to keep control. And it was just to keep a sense of purpose at that point. I felt like that's what I was needed. If I'm not reviewing the returns, then nobody's going to do as good of a job as me. No other accountants know what they're doing. I'm looking at their stuff and they're messing stuff up too. So, you know, I think it was an unhealthy belief that I had to change. So once I realized that I wasn't needed as much there, then I was like, well, I'm not needed much anywhere. And then I got depressed. And then I went through that whole mess. And that whole existential shift is really hard. It's harder than most people may. I think for people like us too, because we're a lot similar. I see your alter ego, so I know how similar we are. But that was the hardest part about it, was the mindset right. shift and getting to that other side. Once I got there, now our firm is more profitable, more successful, more streamlined. Everybody at the team is happier. They're all stronger. They're working together. And that's because I'm not there. I was the problem. Everything that was going wrong with the firm, I was the problem. Without a doubt. And I couldn't admit that. I definitely didn't see that either at that stage. It was just, you know, hindsight's 2020.
It always
right?
is, yeah.
We need, yeah. So I'm a lot more comfortable with that now, because I can admit to myself, you know, it's like we lie to ourselves a lot too. So we think we think we know what we want. Sometimes we don't even know what that
is. Oh, for sure. But, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I can go on for days about that, but I think that's the biggest thing is the mindset shift, you know, and there's a lot more that goes into it, but I think it's being intentional, knowing that you're going to take a hit and having reserves to be able to take that hit. Cause it was a lot of waves in that. We hired a bunch of people. We maybe hired too many because overestimated what people can do. And people can do a lot more than you think too, especially if you give them the ability to do things on their own and be more independent too. Cause I was micromanaging and controlling everything, which stifled their growth as employees and what's possible. And then learning what they're best suited for. Everybody here that we have in the US is client interfacing now. They're that top level. And everybody that we have in the Philippines, which eventually we used to have people that were doing the lower level work here. The people we have in the Philippines are doing a better job at that than anybody I hired here. So that was something else that I learned too, is you can really delegate and outsource it to outsourced areas. I mean, obviously the price is so much different. Clients are fine with it. Like they know we're outsourcing that lower level work, but even if we had somebody here doing it, they wouldn't be talking to them anyway, because they weren't talking to anybody that was doing the actual production work. So interfacing with questions and other things like that. And that's always, you know, you got to figure out processes and ways to go about that. But then you realize that nothing's ever really an emergency if you're not reacting.
Right.
Reacting is what makes everything feel like it's caving in. because you're reacting to everything that's coming in, the emails, and then it's changing course of your day, and it's changing everything you did, and the thing you were supposed to do, you can't get done because you're reacting. So we had to figure out a way to get out of the reaction mode. And it's not by you can't get out of reaction by being proactive, because you'd be proactive with some stuff, but then other fires are still going to start. So whether you were proactive or not, you still have to react. So you got to figure out a way to prevent the fires and put some controls in place there. So a lot of high level stuff, but that's just part of this journey. And yeah, you could, you know, like you got to design your life around that. I know you said you've done presentations on talking about, can working women have it all? Was that what?
Yeah. Yeah. AICPA Engage. It was like, you know, can you have it all? And, you know, maybe you can, but maybe not all at once. Then I think step one is what is your all? Because your all may not be my all.
Yeah. That's what I was like leading into was, once you figure out what your all is and what your cake is that you want to eat, you can have it and eat it too. Once you decide what that is, then you design everything else and reverse engineer it around that. So, you know, for me, my all was I wanted to be a rapper. I've always wanted to do that. That's what I've wanted to do with my life since I was a kid, or entertainer. I figured out a way to kind of do that within accounting too. And it took a while, but that was one of the big things. And entertainment is this show, you know, and other things like that. So I figured that out. That was my all. And it took a long time. I never intentionally set out to do any of this stuff. It just kind of happened. And the things that worked, and the things that didn't work, they were failures, or I saw them as failures along the way. But, you know, it takes being persistent, being identifying what your all is and working backwards to get there. Cause everybody has been able to, well, not everybody, but people have done it. People do have it all. How did they do it? What worked for them and what didn't? And just start looking at others like, that's where I want to be in 2 or 3 years. Then what does it take? What do you got to do differently to get there and be that in 2 or 3 years? So you can have it all, and we're all learning that. I'm still learning. I know nothing. The more I learn, the less I know.
Yeah.
And the less certain I am about anything that I used to believe too. So all of our beliefs are malleable. And I think knowing that too is part of the journey. Like knowing that the things you know now may be different, you know, in the next phase.
I think it's so important to have that flexible mindset in our profession. And I think that's something really good about like our generation that's coming into leadership, is we're a little bit more ready to hear that, right? We're a little bit ready to hear that change is just kind of the status quo now. It's always going to be changing.
Yeah. Yeah. Change is the status quo. Ooh, I like that. That might be the title of this. You've gone through a lot of change, and you're comfortable knowing that you're still probably going to go through a lot more change.
Right.
And that is what we fear. We all fear that change and we want to avoid that pain. But if you know the change is not as painful as we make it out to be, then, and you're ready for it, then you can handle things a lot better. You can handle all those changes and you become a better, you can be more intentional with you can create a response instead of reacting. You create, I think those are the same. Creation and reaction are the same letters, just jumbled a little bit differently. So create and react. I think they are. I don't know. I'm wrong, but that's cool. So give us a little bit of parting wisdom, Sabrina. Give me a fun anecdotal like Twitter story. Like what was the craziest thing that happened to you on Twitter?
Okay. So we haven't got into this yet, but one thing I'm like, I guess Twitter famous for is the whole tax Tinder thing, which, yeah.
Yes, we didn't get it. I wanted to talk about Tomato yeah. Guy too, but we didn't get there yet.
So, yeah. You know.
So, yeah, the tax Tinder. You did start tax Tinder thing. That's hilarious.
I didn't coin the phrase, but I guess I'm the star of tax Tinder, and you know, along with my full transparency.
The star. That's something to aspire to, is being the star of tax Tinder. I love it.
Yeah, in light of full transparency, I've been, you know, really open about what it's like being like a working professional and being like 40 and dating and what that looks like. And so I've shared all kinds of goofy stories from Tinder, for better or for worse. And then like someone from, someone from like a pretty big like tax publication reached out to me and was like, interviewed me and did an article about tax Tinder. And I'm like, this is crazy. I don't know why anyone would want to, but it ended up being really good. It was really tastefully done and professional. And so I thought that was really cool. But yeah, that's my claim to fame.
Well, you're an inspiration for others. Like, there's probably a lot of people that are going through a difficult time, and then they see you in real time going through it with a smile. In a lot of cases, you're making jokes of all of this, like, and it's like human.
Yeah,
you know, you're very human on all of it, and that's why I love like the whole idea of the alter ego, the other persona, because that's more real than anything
else. For sure, yeah. But yeah, you've got to laugh. That's, I mean, so what else are, that's how you get through it. It's really just finding the humor in it.
Well, that's what I found. The people, like the three people I think of on Twitter that are the most real and authentic is you, Nicole Davis, and Laurelyn. Mm. Like, the three of y'all are yourselves all the way through, and you're super honest about everything and supportive and everything else. But I think those, you know, you're in good company with them, and I think that's something that others aspire to be too. Because a lot of people can be reserved, or they don't know what to share, what to say. And you guys are just put it all out there unapologetically and proud of it.
And that's a awesome. High compliment, because, yeah, I definitely feel like I'm in good company.
Oh, yeah. Those are good people. And that's, you know, again, it's a big accomplishment to get to the point where you've got 10,000 followers. It's a big deal. So, you know, I don't know if you get a trophy for that, or if that's like what you're on the Hall of Fame of the tax Twitters, but. Of those, it's probably like 5-8 people or something that have over 10,000.
Yeah, I don't know where they all came from, and I don't know what they want from me, but I guess they're getting it. So,
well, they're getting it, and you're going to keep doing more of it, because this whole journey never ends. We're all just on this all journey together.
That's right.
So, it's going strong. It's going to be good. I appreciate you. Yeah. So, how can our people find you? Ira Gilligan on Twitter.
Ira,
right?
Gilligan on Twitter. Sabrina P. Cook on LinkedIn.
SPC. I love it. You probably should move to South Carolina, because your logo looks like South Carolina.
It kind of does. So. But I don't know, man. That North Carolina pride.
We are the real Carolina. Like, this is, there's North, there's the Carolinas, and then there's South Carolina. And we're in the true, like, true blue state. So thanks, Sabrina. I appreciate you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Bye. Peace out.